The bus trip back to Perth 2 months later took 3 days. Police didn't turn up in the court, so it was put off for another 2 months. I returned to Canberra after meeting Steve for the last time. The 2 months passed, and again I went to the bus station to get a ticket to return to Perth. I had just the right amount of money for a return fare and meals. At the ticket office, the clerk told me that the computers were down and for me to return in a few hours. Having nothing to do and a pocket full of money, I went across the road to the pub to wait. After a few rums, I was in the local brothel having a great time. And 5 hours later, I had spent my entire fare, a far more productive use of the money, I thought. Ainslie Mountain is the best place to go to overlook Canberra. The view borders on being spectacular. About the only thing you can't see very easily from Ainslie Mountain is Ainslie Village. Back in 1986, it was a collection of old army barracks located at the bottom of Ainslie Mountain, hidden from view to the rest of the world, a graveyard for drunks, psychotics and losers, and I fitted in easily. For some while, I've been disappointed with myself and have taken a greater interest in alcohol, buying a 4-litre bottle of port and drinking it in a couple of days or less. The government was paying my wages, and it was enough to pay for my room and meal tickets, plus the alcohol and cigarettes, and pretty soon I had started the downward spiral into occasional alcoholism. Days became blurs and depression a heavy companion, and gradually I became alienated from my daughters, who by now feared the drunken me. The pathway into alcoholism is pretty wide, accommodating all and sundry. It is not discriminatory at all, and certainly not for someone who thought that as he had seen the face of God, he should therefore be exempt from such outrages. Occasionally I get work for months at a time, going off the dole and living a normal lifestyle and hardly drinking at all. Marijuana became affordable, and the drink took second place, but then the work fell off and I wanted something, and all I could afford was the alcohol, and the cycle just got shorter. Sometimes when I got drunk, I'd up and leave there and then, not knowing where I was going, quite often without any money. Late one night, I was drinking in the old Civic Hotel in Canberra. It was bitterly cold with the wind coming up the snowy mountains, and I didn't have a coat, but that didn't stop me. I put down my glass and went outside and started hitching a ride, and within half an hour, standing on the Monaro Highway, a main road down to Melbourne, trying to find another lift. Within 10 minutes, the car with 4 occupants stopped a short distance in front of me. Somebody leaned out of the window and loudly asked if I was going to Melbourne, and I yelled back I was, though I didn't know it till then. There were 3 men and a girl inside, and they all seemed pretty friendly. They told me they'd been to a Buddhist meeting in Sydney and were heading back to Melbourne, which was 1,000 kilometres from Sydney and 600 from Canberra. They said their teacher had told them that they would be picking up a man and they were taking him to Melbourne, and that's why they yelled out the window first to make sure I was the one who was going to Melbourne. I'd usually got a pinch of salt in my pocket, but as I was close to hypothermia, so I just thanked them for stopping. We drove all through the night, only stopping to get petrol, and as the sun came up, we reached the outskirts of Melbourne. My older cousin Brian lived in the eastern suburbs, and I had decided to go and see him, though I knew he wouldn't be happy to see me. He said I was a bit of a disappointment because I'd dropped out and had let my family down by leaving them. My driver insisted on driving me to his house, and as it was still early in the morning when we arrived, I crept into the back of Brian's old car to wait for some reasonable time before knocking on his door. It was 9 o'clock when I awoke, and I hadn't heard anybody come out of the house, so I went and knocked on the back door, and his wife Trish opened it. She was a district nurse and a sympathetic soul, and she ushered me in out of the cold, sitting me down while she poured me a hot drink. We talked about everything except Brian. They had 3 school-aged children, and she told me I'd missed them, and they'd all gone and all left for school. So I'm thinking about Miss Brian too while I dozed in the back of his old car. "What time does Brian get home from work?" I asked, and she looked at me a bit nonplussed and said, "Brian's here, didn't you know?" "Know what?" "Brian's dying of cancer," she said. I was shocked. She took me in to see him and left us alone. The room was dark and musty, and Brian's 2-meter frame was just skin on bones. I hadn't seen him for over a year, and I thought he would be as fit as ever. He appeared to be asleep, but he opened his eyes and slowly whispered that he was glad to see me, which was a surprise, considering the last time I was there, he was very angry indeed. Awkwardly, I held his hand and we talked for a while, and he told me he was sorry we had argued, and then wished me farewell. The tears came to my eyes, and I told him I'd see him again some other time. He attempted a smile as I bent down and kissed his forehead, and quietly I left his room. I left back to Canberra that afternoon was with a biplane flyer. We stopped off at an old farmhouse outside Albury on the Victoria New South Wales border, where he showed me an old World War I plane he was helping to rebuild. I got the feeling he wanted to show me something else, so I was keen to get going. On about the fifth day back in Canberra, I found Trish, and she told me she'd buried Brian the day before. It was 12 years before I saw Trish again. I had Amanda and Debs with me on a business trip down to Melbourne. How things changed. I had booked a room in a hotel, in a city motel, and we had gone to a show in a brand new hire car, and then on to a good restaurant. The following day, we drove 150 kilometers south and met Trish and her new husband and her grown-up children at another good restaurant. Later, the conversation got around to Brian, and I told Trish of the strange lift I got outside Canberra on my way down to see Brian just before he died. "Brian was a Buddhist," she said matter-of-factly. My ex-wife had moved from Canberra to Sydney and was living with her fiancé and my two girls, and I didn't know where in Sydney. Money was again a problem. And I was staying at the Salvation Army House for Men in Auburn, Sydney. Someone there had stolen my wallet and my driver's license and what little money I had. So I had to stay longer than I wanted. Some 2 years before, I met two Irishmen at Ainslie Village who were carpenters working on the new Federal Parliament building on Capitol Hill. Both were heavy drinkers, but that was normal for Irishmen, and nothing was thought about it. But one of them, I think his name was Jerry, one day sold his tools to pay for beer. Now there is nothing more precious to a carpenter than his tools. So what he did was a sign that he had gone over the edge, and everybody who liked him was saddened. He disappeared from the village, and I hadn't seen him till he called into the Sally's house in Mount Auburn for a free meal. His clothes were old and dirty, and his brain had gone from the alcoholic lobotomy. He couldn't remember me, and the nasty person inside who guarded his empty shell came out and warned me off. I've seen this character before in other terminal alcoholics, and knew how vicious he is, so I did just that. By adding vitamin B to beer, it will stop this liquid lobotomy. But the brewers say that would change the taste and ruin the flavour, which is fair. But one day somebody is going to sue the brewers and win, and they'll all have to compete with a similar tasting drop. Unless, of course, a chemist comes up with a tasteless vitamin B in the meantime. When I was a truck driver a few years before, I had a supervisor named Kevin Thompson who was so strong that legend had it that he had lifted a V8 engine without a block and tackle. Lifting out a V8 engine without a block and tackle. Kevin had been a farmer who, like many farmers, had turned to truck driving to save his family farm from the banks, and like other farmers, could work sleepless for days at a time. He had to so he could pay for their truck, which he was trying to save from the repossession by the finance company. Kevin was a friend, and a friend indeed is a friend indeed, whatever that means. about the only thing I had left was my address book, and though I hadn't seen Kevin for a year or so, I knew he would help, and sure enough, within an hour he picked me up from my prison in Auburn, and we sped off towards Sydney town in his big Ford getaway car. Now that was all good, but I still didn't have a place to stay or any money for food. Kevin offered to loan me some money so I could get a flat somewhere, and knowing that I'd pay him back, I took up the offer. I found a small furnished flat in Blair Street, Weyburn, and Kevin paid with his credit card, and I moved in that afternoon. With the small cash loan he gave me, I went to the local supermarket to get some food, and there at the checkout counter was my ex-wife and daughter, Deborah. So I've done this sort of thing before. Back in 1979, when I had a mini-mix concrete business in Canberra, I got drunk one Saturday night and slept it off in my car, which I'd driven into the courtyard of a deserted farmhouse. When I awoke in the morning, my mouth tasted terrible, so I went looking for some water. I saw a tap by a doorway, and I proceeded to wash my mouth out and splash my face. And then I realized that the door was actually a new-looking sliding door, and on the inside I could see new carpet. Strange, I thought, for a deserted farmhouse. So I slid the door open and went in. A voice was talking in the distance, so I called out, "Hello," so as not to alarm them with my presence. And suddenly a young man appeared. He introduced himself and offered me a cup of tea. He led me into a room where many people were sitting listening to the owner of the voice. No one paid me much attention, except the young man who poured me a cup of tea. I guessed it was a sales meeting of sorts, and obviously he thought I was a participant. But then I noticed the AA banner on the wall, and I realized I walked into an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. Years later, I was to return under my own steam. Diane, my ex-wife, was very upset to see me and was convinced I had been spying on her. When I explained how I just arrived in Sydney and had no clue where she was living, she calmed down. When I told her where my flat was, she became even more upset and asked me what I was up to. "Nothing," was my reply. "I just wanted to see my girls who I hadn't seen for about 4 months." She asked me if I was trying to ruin their lives, and I said, "No, of course not." But she was too upset to believe me. Probably my flat must be close to her place, I thought. But even I was taken back when I learned that they were virtually opposite. I ended up staying there about 5 weeks before I had to leave. I couldn't afford the rent, and it was just too close. The thing that really upsets me is I never paid Kevin back his loan. It was to be 3 years before I had the money, and by then Kevin and his family had disappeared. The halfway house for Langton Creek was located at North Bondi. It sat on the edge of the cliff, and a short walk up to the inner garden, and you had a convenient drop over the side. Langton Clinic was a New South Wales government institution for helping drug and alcohol overusers get back to shore. A 3-week intensive counselling course, followed by 1 year of relatively normal living, was the answer for many people harangued by the addictive drugs co-sponsored by governments. My lifestyle had deteriorated to the point where I was often weighed down with a black depression from excessive drinking. The adventures of a drunk loses its charm after a while, and so I started to swim back, keen to try the Abstainers Anonymous group again. Previous alcohol abstentions had lasted for months, and they had been quite enjoyable, but the problem for me was the links between the caffeine crave and the nicotine crave appeared to inflame the alcohol crave, and they all fed off each other. This time, against the orders of the clinical psychologist, I stopped taking all three drugs. If I didn't drink tea or coffee, I found the craving for a smoke dramatically decreased, and the thought of having an alcoholic drink only happened irregularly. It seemed to work. 5 years later, visiting friends at Maria on the south coast, I had a cup of tea and shortly after the craving for a cigarette returned with a vengeance. Fortunately, no one with me smoked, and within a few minutes the intense desire had passed off. But I'll never forget how strong it felt. The new millennium presents an opportunity to change the Western symbol of measuring years from the birth of a Christian religious symbol to something more specific to the 21st century. It's roughly 100,000 years since Homo sapiens sapiens evolved and started to colonize this planet. With the completion of the Iridium project in September 1988, a ring of satellites will circle the globe that will allow for instant worldwide communication anywhere on Earth from a handheld phone. This pinnacle of Homo sapiens sapiens scientific achievement could be observed by changing the date from 2001 AD to IR1, IR being the chemical symbol for iridium, atomic number 77 on the periodic table. Time prior to iridium 00 will remain in the Christian calculations until the death of the present generation and the acceptance of IR minus years. Being born in 1944, my birth year would be IR 56, so it has the advantage of revealing my age, IR minus 56, so it has the advantage of revealing my age as of the year 2000, or IR 0. My fight with alcohol is coming to a close. The psychologist at Langton Clinic were led by the indomitable Pat Gallagher, whose task was to break down the alcohol-inflated ego, allowing for reconstruction of a more social model. The fear she instilled was almost awesome. She gave no quarter, took no prisoners. Either the patient responded to treatment or was shown the door. While I was in prison, she gave me a formal lecture. She gave a formal lecture to the assembled patients, and if my memory is correct, said one of the most profound things I'd ever heard. There isn't anyone who doesn't believe in God. A shuffling of feet meekly showed disagreement. Her words continued that put in a position of unexpected imminent death, everyone asked God for help. It was such a logical statement that I never doubted it. Pat to me was a laser light of sanity, whom I thought must one day, ironically, succumb to the same alcohol and nicotine monsters she so beautifully rallied against. Anyone so successful in turning people away from the worship of Bacchus, the god of the vine, must surely risk being dragged before his altar to make a toast to Bacchus. Having seen the reflection of God's face and knowing he is a male seems unfair. Before a fetus becomes a male, it must first go through the same embryonic stages as a female embryo. So every male has a common sex foundation with the female. With that in mind, it seems reasonable that the second most abundant element in the universe is helium, chemical symbol HE. The fact that the males and the females are so close biologically suggests to me that the male of the species is a much later addition, designed to serve the female. The distinction between the sexes is so dramatic and can be observed in any room. Just look around and try to find something invented or built by a female. Males appear to make everything to please and comfort their partners. This then prompts the question, did God build the universe to please a prior female god, who is also God? Hydrogen, which makes up roughly 75% of the universe, the helium 24, has the chemical symbol H, pronounced H. To live in a halfway house, I had to agree to attend the Alcoholics Anonymous meeting daily. For a long while, I would sit there listening, dreading the thought that I would be called upon to stand up and talk. I heard all the variations of my own story, and after a while it became easy to join my thread into the tapestry that was our lives on the sea of excess. As my performance became more polished, I gained the courage to look into the faces of my audience and not run away, though I was never comfortable. While sitting at the back of the rooms, I noticed that the vast majority of men attending had full heads of hair, which suggested to me a genetic predisposition to alcohol abuse. As I have patent baldness, some might think that this was a sign of denial. Could be. But I believe the real alcoholics are the people drinking large amounts of it, not those who don't. Am I a drug addict if I take heroin once a month, once a week, once a day, or not at all? To me, people who have stopped drinking are no longer alcoholics. They shouldn't weigh themselves down with this lack of label. They should lighten up and celebrate their success after surviving the ride on the twisting tiger. On the wall of the AA meeting would usually be displayed the tenets of recovery, the 12 steps. Step 1 necessitated meeting the alcohol and dominant role in my life. Step 2 got me to agree that I wasn't powerful enough to usurp it and required the help of a power greater than myself, in my case, God. Step 3 told me to relax and slip the drive gear into neutral and just coast along, letting the great power take control. Step 4 and 5 urged me to tell all my secrets to someone else, thus unburdening myself of that weight. The therapeutic results from this are surprising. I literally felt lighter after following this step. Step 6, stay in neutral. Step 7, 8, and 9, apologize, apologize, and apologize. Steps 10, 11, 12, stay tight, keep cool, and help any followers up the steps. Within 6 weeks, I had completed all the steps to my satisfaction. It was easy for me to stop drinking alcohol, but much harder for cigarettes and the caffeine. I never had a craving for marijuana, because to me it's not addictive. Once I was out of the halfway house, I virtually stopped going to any meetings. I now go once every 5 years, simply because I've never wanted to drink. So there was no real point in going except curiosity and maybe to help others. My next meeting is on October the 14th, 2004. I did go to a meeting on that day, but it was closed. The 12th step is the one I found the most interesting. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to our alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. My spiritual awakening was literally waking up in my bed in the early hours of the morning in the halfway house and feeling that the room was full of angels. Though I couldn't see anybody, the intense love for me that I felt pervading the dimly lit room caused me to feel a presence so strong to this day I imagine I did see them sitting on the spare bed, on top of the wardrobe, on the floor, all in a golden glow and happily in attendance to me. Maybe I did. There are some impressive houses around the back streets of Double Bay. It's probably the second or third wealthiest area of Sydney after Falklands, which is just 2 or 3 kilometres further east. The high walls covered in creepers don't hide the large abodes behind them, but add to the mystique and grandeur that walks slowly down the streets, free to be inhaled deeply. This was how I was spending a sunny winter Sunday, appreciating the work of past architects. That splendid style is gone from the new buildings that I have seen. Only the old one seems to hold on to. My wanderings brought me to a little park, which in the late afternoon glistened with magic. I can imagine Peter Pan finding interest in this park, and water running fast into a catchment well raised the thought of adventure in my mind. A gentle smoke had prepared the stage for excitement, and I could feel the magic as it swirled around, touching the boundaries of my 4, maybe 5 dimensions. The water had come down the small hill along a pebbled gut, jumping and bouncing till it reached the well where a minor maelstrom roared. And then it was sucked away. The hill offered an invitation, So I followed the stream up to the ferns until it came to a large drain water. Came to a huge stormwater drain, large enough for me to enter without bowing, and then I went to explore the man-made cave. For some reason I can't remember, unless it was because it was Sunday, I was all dressed up, suit and tie and best shoes. There was plenty of room to walk alongside the stream, and I entered deeper inside the cave, looking for anything unusual, pirates, coconuts, whatever. Towards the end of the tunnel, a smaller diameter pipe branched up on an incline, so I climbed up into it. Now, I had to bend down and straddle the stream of fast-flowing water. I had no urge to go back, only forward. So even when the pipe size required me to completely bend over, the incline grew deeper. I kept on climbing upwards. The pipes kept getting smaller until I was crawling up the incline in the dark, with the water rushing into my chest, depositing pebbles and sand inside my shirt and pockets. By now I figured I'd travelled 500 metres with no end in sight and was weighing a lot more than when I started out. The incline was about 45 degrees and rushing water made the pipe into a potential water slide. But unfortunately, when I started my ascent, I had to crawl over reinforcing steel bars that were jutting out upwards, waiting to impale me should I slip and be carried downwards. The elbows and knees of my suit were soon worn through, and the coarse surface of the pipe coupled with the water was grazing my softened skin. Fear went through me like a wave, halting my progress and draining all my energy. If the pipes ahead were smaller diameter, I would not be able to go any further anyway, but I couldn't go back to certain impediment, so I kept moving slowly forward, my chest a battering ram against the water. Gradually the water volume appeared to be increasing, and I realized it might have started raining. The thought of a rushing torrent suddenly appearing made me quicken my crawl, and to my relief, the angle of my ascent started to level out. Up ahead, I could see a light, and the devil of torment left my company. I knew then I would be okay. I figured I was somewhere under Bondi Junction, so I kept crawling towards salvation. The optimism diminished when I eventually reached the drain hole grid. It wasn't raining, but I appeared to be in a back street somewhere. I couldn't hear any traffic noise, and I couldn't shift the cast iron grating. There was no option but to get back into the pipe and continue crawling, still hoping that the pipes didn't get any smaller. About an hour had gone by since I first entered my adventure cave, and the 15 or so minutes to the next grid seemed just as long. Again, there was no room to move, and I couldn't shift the iron grating, but at least the sun had come out, and I could hear traffic, so back into my tunnel I went. It was two more grids before I found one with enough room to enable me to get my back underneath and push it open. The grid fell back, and I stood up in the drain in the street. I was on Edgecliff Road in Woollahra, the suburb adjoining Bondi Junction, and I had come out from the traffic lights. The first thing I noticed was a man sitting in his convertible, waiting for the lights to change. He was staring at me and his mouth was open. Acute embarrassment made me drop back down into my drain, waiting until I heard the traffic move on. Sodden and bedraggled, I left a trail of water as I made my way home to my guest house half a kilometre away. For some reason, the drain hole on the corner of Edgecliff Road and Grosvenor Street has been concreted over, maybe to dissuade others from using it as a shortcut to Bombay. Australia was colonised by the British in 1788. The shape of the continent suggests its destiny. The left side looks like an English fox terrier, and the right like a wombat. A big, gentle, furry animal in marsupial. The capital, Canberra, is located in... The capital of Canberra is located in the Australian Capital Territory, whose borderline with New South Wales strongly resembles a kookaburra sitting on a tree branch. Kookaburras are birds well known for their loud noises. Tasmania looks like a medieval drawing of a devil's head, with Flinders Island and King Island acting as its horns, and in some maps, it is also bears a fair resemblance to its fair little marsupial, the Tasmanian devil. It was named Van Diemen's Land by Abel Tasman in 1642, after his patron. The name of Diemen is usually pronounced Diemen. My reason for adding this last paragraph is simply because of a feeling I get that there is more to certain events and situations than just being coincidental. From my vision of God's face, it seems to me that God displays the same duality that life supposedly possesses, both wave and particle. If you look at him up close, you'll see the particles which are ourselves. And when you pull back and view the whole face, you can see the beautiful waves. And if everything in the universe breaks down into electromagnetic radiation, or light for short, and he is the light, then the assumption could be correct. The final coincidence. I have just finished writing these words and I picked up by mistake my McMillan Compact Encyclopedia to check the scientific meaning of the word parasite, and the first word I saw was pantheism, any belief or doctrine presenting the natural world, including man, as part of the divine. If I had been asked 10 minutes ago to define that word, I wouldn't have known the correct answer. Bernard William Palmer. Bernard Palmer at cashrousband.com, 1st of March, IR-1.